This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at the Zen Center of New York City. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of Zen Mountain Monastery and ZCNYC. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about the temple's retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org/ZCNYC. Thanks for listening.
This is from Master Dogen's 300 Koan Shobo Genzo. Case 261, Yunmen composes a verse, the main case. Master Yunmen was once asked by a student, "How do we not waste time throughout the day?" Yunmen said, "How do you focus on this question?" The student said, "I don't know, Master. Please instruct me." Then Yunmen composed a verse and gave it to the student. "If you don't pay attention, you will miss it. If you think about it, in what eon will you realize it?" The commentary. The student goes to Yunmen seeking crumbs and is instead served a 6-course meal. Lowering your head and lingering in thought, trying to figure it out with your intellect, simply moves you further from the truth. Yet if you don't pay attention, you'll surely miss it. Now tell me, without falling into intellect, without being caught up in affirmation and negation, how do you understand paying attention without thinking? Have you heard Master Yaoshan's teaching? Think, not thinking. How do you think, not thinking? Non-thinking. We should understand that non-thinking is not just to transcend thinking and not thinking, but to realize both as this very life itself. Non-thinking is objectless, subjectless, formless, goalless, and purposeless. But it is not a vacuum devoid of vitality in life. It is rather the self-fulfilling samadhi of joyous activity, the life of the Buddha's ancestors, your life, my life, and to miss it is to miss life itself. Daroshi's verse. 10,000 kinds of clever talk, how can they be compared to the great reality? From within the myriad forms, the single body is revealed. Oh, good morning, everyone. It's good to be here. This question, how do we not waste time throughout the day, I think is a uniquely human question. Does any creature ask this question? Does a tree, a mountain, a cloud ask this question? As we spoke about yesterday in the human realm in Buddhism, what makes us human is that we can choose and imagine. And so recognizing that this one day of life is here now and will never return again, ever. Never to come back. In formal training, at the end of a day of practice, waking up and doing zazen and liturgy and work practice, taking care of inner and outer throughout the day, and then ending the day with zazen in silence and stillness. And then the liturgist sings a bedtime lullaby. Let me respectfully remind you, life and death are of supreme importance. Time so swiftly passes by and opportunities are lost. Each of us should strive to awaken. Take heed, do not squander this life. Dadaroshi speaks about non-thinking is objectless, subjectless, formless, purposeless. And yet each of us wants a purposeful life. We want to feel like our lives have been well spent. I think that must be true, that no one wants to live their life or end their life thinking that their life was worth nothing, had no value. How they measure that, of course, varies widely. But that sense of wanting a meaningful life, a purposeful life. And then what does that mean? How do we figure that? Because that feeds directly into how we use this day and how we have a sense of whether this life has been well spent. In the Guide to a Bodhisattva Way of Life, Shantideva said, just as all of the Buddhas of the past embrace the awakened attitude of mind, and in the precepts of the Bodhisattvas, step by step by step, abode and trained, just so, and for the benefit of all, I will also have this attitude of mind. And in the precepts, step by step, I will abide and train myself. That this most pure and spotless state of mind might be embraced and constantly increased. The prudent, the wise, who have cultivated it, should praise it highly in such words as these. Today, my life has given fruit. Today, my life has benefit. This human state that I so preciously occupy has now been well assumed. Today I take my birth in Buddha's line and have become the Buddha's child and heir. As I spoke about yesterday, to be a child of the Buddha, as often as comes up in the teachings, is not to infantilize, but rather to recognize we are in the family of Buddhas, and we are the heir to enlightenment, to enlightened nature, to an awakened life. Master Zhao Zhou was once asked by a student, how do I use the 24 hours of the day? And Zhao Zhou said, do not be used by them. And we can understand that in a very simple way, but he's actually saying something very profound. You could say that about everything that we experience. A relationship, an encounter, a mind, a thought stream, an emotion, a world event. How do we put each and every of these experiences that we have into service towards our own liberation? Which must include that our life is a benefit towards others. Rather than that thing, that phenomena, putting us in servitude to it. How do you put your mind in service to your own liberation rather than being at the mercy of your own mind? It's really an essential principle of Buddhist practice. Dukkha is the first noble truth of dukkha, that life is dukkha, is based in a sort of a view, inner and outer, that we want a purposeful life. We want pleasure and happiness and joy and contentment. And the way we're going to go about that is by controlling our way to happiness. Controlling others, controlling situations, controlling ourselves. Well, the evidence is in. It's never happened. It's never worked for anybody, anywhere. And so practice is giving up that control within a purposeful life. And that tension, that meeting place, is what Dada Roshi is speaking about here. Non-thinking is objectless, subjectless, formless, goalless, purposeless, but it is not a vacuum devoid of vitality and life. And so intellectually, it can be very difficult to understand that. How is that supposed to work? But we don't resolve it intellectually. That's why we spend the morning doing direct practice, liturgy, prostrations, zazen. Not intellectualizing this, but going right to the heart of it. And this question, how to not waste time throughout the day, is not about being productive, getting ahead, beating time, beating death, you know, being the one who wins. It's not about that. It's about today my life has given fruit. Today my life has become, or rather I have realized my life to be complete. How do we not waste time throughout the day? Dada Roshi's footnote says, at all costs, we should try to avoid foolish questions. And it was part of, you know, Buddhist practice, it's important to understand, is really a path of inquiry, an examination. But we have to learn how to examine, right? Because our ordinary way of doing that is very intellectual, very conceptual, is very dualistic. You know, there's a problem, we need to fix it. If you haven't fixed it, you're just not thinking hard enough, or else you just failed. And this is not that. That's what binds us in this path towards objectless, purposeless, and vitality. And that's why we have to practice, because that's where we work it out. How do you be devoted to a period of zazen, to really doing practice in that moment? And be sincere and put your ass on the line. Right? To sit like your life depends upon it, because when we really see closely, it does. And how do you do that without clutching, without grasping, without clinging, without setting standards, without bringing tools of measurement? We have to discover that. We have the capacity, every single person has the capacity to do that. But we have to discover how to do that and discover it over and over and over again. And we discover it where it matters, where it really counts. That's why it's important to know what are the important questions. Not only because they direct us towards what is actually important, you know, because when we realize we're not going to live forever, really realize that, then who would want to waste time? And so it helps to direct us towards what's actually important, but it also establishes something within us, a different way of being, right, which is vital and vibrant. The Buddha said that one of the four ways of misusing speech is to chatter idly. And that can seem very superficial and sort of trivial, but it really means sort of numbing ourselves with just idle chatter, or in a sense wasting language, wasting our mind, wasting those moments. And so how do we know what is important amidst a cacophony of voices who are all telling you what's important? This is what's important, this is what's important, this is what's important. How do we know that for ourselves? That's really, I mean, in a sense, that's bodhicitta, the way-seeking mind. When bodhicitta arises, that's the expression or the experience of really coming into contact with what matters most. You know, and probably all of us will come face to face with that eventually, if not sooner, in our moments leading up to our death, or lots of the things that we've been so preoccupied with, or the important things in our life that we have been preoccupied with in not healthy ways, begins to fall away. Because in those final moments where we realize now they're final moments, we realize what's important. I've seen that over and over and over again. Doesn't always happen, actually. And I've seen that too. How do you focus on that question, Yunmen asks? How do you ask the question? Right? I mean, we ask questions all the time. But in a sense, we have to learn, how do I ask a question, a real question? One way of asking is that I already know the answer. I ask, but I already know. I already have a sense. I have something formed in my mind already. I was speaking with somebody recently who was exploring the possibility of being a student, and they wanted to know, would the teacher be able to meet the student where they were. And I said, what do you mean by that? Because that can mean different things. And what I heard in their response was that the student already has some, or the person wanting to be a student, already has some pretty clear ideas about things and wanted to know if the teacher would affirm that. And so I spoke a little bit about what being a student means. That it's really, as Suzuki Roshi said, a full, somebody who knows everything has very little need for questions, right? But they have lots of answers, which means they have very little to learn. There's very little that can truly penetrate and impact them. How do you focus on a question? A student once asked Master Dongshan, another great master, that same question. And Dongshan said, you don't ask it with your lips and your tongue. It's not in the words. You ask it with your whole body and mind. Your whole being wants to know. And so this path of inquiry, when we engage the Dharma, we begin studying, we encounter those things that are most important. That's what the Dharma is presenting us with. These are the things that if we're really genuinely interested in a life of peace and joy and compassion and being a benefit in the world, these are the things that we want to bring our attention to. If that's not what we're interested in, then move along. You know. But if we're interested, these are the things we will want to know. Because these are the things that are both obstructing that deep desire and are also the doorways. But even to think in terms of a question, right, can also create complications. Because then sometimes, because we're sort of looking at it from a dualistic view, it's like, okay, well, what is the question I'm supposed to be asking, right? What is the right question? I don't want to ask a wrong question. Is this a profound question? I don't want to ask a superficial question. And we get all hung up in, it's sort of like, how do I express love? Well, be love. Experience love, and then you'll know how to express it. Know what's going on inside, and then we will know what the question is. Be in contact with our lives. Be in contact with our suffering. And that will guide us in what the questions are. And a question is also just a vehicle. It's just language, a word that can express something. But it also does, its power is in that which resides within us. And it's a living thing, right? It's not a fixed thing. You know, the ways that I would express my questions, my concerns when I first came into practice, in a sense, are still there, some of them have sort of been resolved and passed away, but the essence of it, the deepest parts, are still there, but how I experience them, how I would articulate them, express them, has largely changed a great deal. This path of inquiry, it really is based in mindfulness. We have to have mindfulness in order for this to have a place to land, in a sense. Because when our mind is distracted, it's very difficult to be in contact with those more subtle aspects of ourselves and our lives, right? That's one of the challenges of a busy life, of a full life, of a very outwardly expressed life. Not that inherently any of those things are problematic, but that the energy that in order to really make contact, there needs to be a certain degree of stillness and silence and time and patience. And that's why, as so many of you have experienced in Zazen, in a day of intensive sitting like Zazen Kai, in Sesshin, we make contact. You come into contact with yourself in a different way. It's not that anything new is there, but we're just experiencing it directly, intimately. Whereas later, that moment of contact can become more of a memory. We remember, but the sort of visceral, direct experience of that is not quite the same. And so that's why it's, you know, training includes all of this. It's important that we have, create space and time in which we can have access. Because as Dada Roshi says, the tendency is, you know, lower our head and linger in thought. We'll try and figure it out. He says, trying to figure it out with your intellect simply moves us further away from the truth. Right? Because it becomes more abstract, it becomes objectified. We're trying to figure something out rather than just directly experiencing. And mindfulness, as important as it is, ultimately isn't enough to dissolve the roots, in a sense, to resolve the essence of those questions. That's direct experience. We spoke about that quite a bit yesterday. The beliefs, the ideas, the assumptions that we have, that we base our lives in, they remain, the roots of those remain intact. The essential view that I exist as an independent entity, the self, and that you all are independent entities and everything exists separately, that remains intact. And so we have to see into our deep nature, our inner workings. And so Dada Roshi says, without falling into intellect, without being caught up in the affirmation, negation, yes and no, the right answer, the wrong answer, how do we understand paying attention without thinking? Right? What is attention? In Buddhism, attention has a very particular meaning. It's directing your mind. So when you sit down and you direct your mind to your breath, that's your attention. That's the function of attention. When something arises and you see whether it's wholesome, helpful, in alignment with the Dharma, or whether it's deluded, creating suffering, that's what the Buddha called ardency. Recognizing, in a sense, its moral quality, whether it's helping you, serving you, or whether it's hindering you. Because we need to know. We need to be able to navigate that. We need to know, how do I respond to this that is arising? And so when we begin sitting, we see, you know, lots of clouds and dust, in the language of the Dharma, karmic obstructions, memories, emotions, fantasies, fears, hurts, resentments. We see them. And in the beginning, we tend to just get pulled into them, pulled into them, pulled into them, pulled into them. Right? They have the most power. And what we're seeing is that our mindfulness is not yet very powerful. Right? We get a glimpse of it, but then we disappear. We get a glimpse of it, then we disappear. Right? So there's very little stability. But with time, what happens is we're able to, as those arise, we're able to see them more securely, more with more stability. Right? We don't get so easily drawn in. We're still affected. Right? We still feel the sort of emotional impact. We feel, you know, disturbed, upset, whatever it might be happening. But we're able to be aware that that's happening. There is some spaciousness developing. We call that detachment. And we're beginning to recognize these patterns and beginning to see them as karmic. We're beginning to see how the construction of these. So we begin to realize it's not you. It's not who you are. It's not your identity, although we will have generally created an identity around it, that's not an authentic thing. And so that too is more detachment, more spaciousness. We're not getting so drawn in, right? Stability. And just think about this. Think about this in our world. walking down the street, right? There's so much stimulation. There's so many sensations, so many things to see, sounds, people, right? Things calling out. And in a sense, our senses are wired to be responding to constantly, right? Is this safe? Is this dangerous? Do I move towards it? Do I move away? And so just walking down the street can be a source of just complete distraction. And so it's a good practice in the city to walk down the street, not blinding yourself with blinders, but to be mindful in walking down the street. Eyes up, eyes open, perceiving, but not getting lost in what you perceive. In a sense, being the master of within, not in a controlled sense, but in a not getting lost sense. That's mindfulness. And then as things continue to settle down, how is it when something arising and there's no reaction? No thought, no label, no judgment, no emotion comes forth, just that, just this. There's still awareness, still self-awareness, but the movement doesn't disturb. And so now you take walking down the street and make it larger, right? Reading the news, hearing of events, right? Things that are going on in your life, all of this activity, all of this movement, right? Where do we find our ground? Not to cling on to and not to escape into or away from, but to provide some stability within which to experience. As Dadarishi says, we're not seeking a vacuum devoid of vitality of life, but rather a self-fulfilling samadhi, which is concentration of joyous activity. And so Dadarishi takes Yunmen's poem. If you don't pay attention, you'll miss it. But if you think about it, in what eon will you realize it? The answer is never. And in his commentary, he's drawing upon a dialogue, an ancient dialogue between Master Weishan, who was sitting in meditation, and a student came up and says, "Master, what are you thinking sitting there so fixedly?" And yet Weishan said, "I'm thinking of not thinking." And the student says, "How do you think of not thinking?" And the master said, "Non-thinking." And Dadarishi is making it clear this is not just a matter of not thinking. Non-thinking is non-dual. He says it's not just to transcend thinking and not thinking. You know, because if we base our alleviation of suffering, our freedom, on not thinking, then what do you do in all of the moments when you need to think? If that aspect of our consciousness is not included in our liberation, how's that supposed to work? And so thinking, as is true with every phenomena, is not what binds us. And it's what binds us to thoughts or anything that we're trying to practice freeing ourselves of. And then thought and all phenomena are freed. Master Huainong said, "Do not imprison the many beings in your mind." Master Dogen said, "If we are not the sort of person who is afraid of what is near, then we may have the courage and the thinking to question sitting fixedly." In other words, he's saying to even address this, to get close to this, we have to have a certain amount of courage to be able to ask this question: how do I not waste time throughout the day? I have to have a certain amount of courage, in part because I have to recognize the possibility that I am wasting my life. Right? And that's a painful thing to contemplate. And so it requires courage to ask that question. You know, when we think, you know, one way of sort of helping, I think, of looking at the world that we're in and understanding it is if you see it as just a sort of big performance of what's happening in our own minds. And so when we see all of the bluster and the loudness and the conflict and the disquiet, happening all around us, you know, do we see the seeds of all of that within us? Right? Because that's where it comes from. Right? This is all human activity. It's all coming from the bodies and the words and the thoughts of human beings, individually and collectively. It's mind. And it can help us to see it as something that's not so other and understand it, because as you examine your own mind, in a sense, in a very real sense, you're examining the mind of all beings. So one way of thinking about all of that is how much of our thinking is true, right? So there's the activity of our mind that's just like gibberish. You know, it's not even complete sentences. It's just blah, just noise, right? That's really the easy stuff. I mean, you have to practice it because it's got energy and it's chaotic and it's frequent. But it's easy because the roots of that don't go so deep. It doesn't mean much, right? It's just... And so with just steady, patient practice, that drops away. But then more obsessive thoughts, looping, cycling thoughts, thoughts about things in our life, about other people, about relationships, about work, about the world. And so it's easy to get caught in that because we're thinking about things that matter. But a way to practice that is ask yourself, but when you're thinking about it in that moment, is that thinking process actually helping? So much of the time it's not. It's not constructive thought. It's not actually thinking. I spoke about this yesterday. We're not thinking about something. Your mind is thinking you, right? We're sort of at the mercy of a kind of obsessive thought stream that isn't constructive because it has no real awareness. It has no power. And so when we recognize that, that can also help us to let go of that, because you can realize, yes, I need to address this, but this is not doing that. And so let me give some time to do that later. And then to think mindfully is a very powerful thing. It's one of the dangers of, you know, like when you're sitting a lot or you're in session and your mind has become very still and something comes to mind that is very powerful, important, and now you could think about it very powerfully, right? But you're doing session, right? So you need to set that aside and come back to that because it is important, but try and preserve that time because that time is precious. All dharmas are formless, empty of any permanence, any permanent characteristic. We spoke about this yesterday. Anything, any inherent quality. And that's true of our thoughts. And at the same time, that doesn't mean that they're insignificant. They can be significant in how much they bind us. They can also be significant in how much they can serve. You know, bodhicitta, the way-seeking mind, citta means mind and thought. So it has that aspect of just your sort of the inner emotional experience of urgency. But it also has the sense of thought about the Dharma, enlightened thinking, or thinking about enlightenment in a way that's actually helpful. Not just, you know, as a party conversation piece, but actually as part of your practice. Dogen said, when we realize the self is empty, that we are enlightened by the 10,000 things, and to be enlightened by the 10,000 things is to free your body and mind and the body and mind of others. That in the moment of realizing your own liberation, you realize everybody is liberated. It also helps us to see the body and mind that is not freed of self and other. And that's extremely important. You know, we just want to get enlightened. But really, it's the deep examination, in a very significant way, is about our delusion. We're deeply examining all that binds us, all that hinders, holds us back, creates suffering. The mind and body of self and other. And so when we hear someone speaking, when we hear white folks talking about people who should go back to their country where they came from, when we hear white folks talking about people who are intruders, when we see people in a dominant group who are afraid and therefore angry, because it's hard to hold fear, angry at people of other groups who are demanding to live and speak and have the benefit of what dominant groups have and have had for years. When we see people who are afraid, white people who are afraid at other white people who are trying to be a part of a real change as allies and accomplices. When we see people who are angry and scornful and hateful and violent. When we see people in positions of high power who are inciting that and encouraging that at the very same moment or alternate moments that they're denying it. And we see that deception. When we see those words, we recognize those, we see those actions. We're seeing bodies and minds that are not freed, that are not studied, not examined, that are deeply mired in false views, dangerously false views, who are deeply committed to those views. We're seeing actions and words that are clearly not enlightened, but deeply deluded. And we're seeing the poison, the three poisons, greed, anger, delusion, pride, and jealousy. We're seeing fear and insecurity. We're seeing distraction from the inner beings of those people. And those people are us at various moments as we act out of those places in our own ways. We're seeing the teachings made manifest. And that can really help us to see and understand it karmically, in terms of people's individualized, in terms of history, nationally. You know, there's this incredible series that the Times is doing on 1619, you know, our 400th year of the continuing legacy that began 400 years ago with the first Africans brought as slaves, kidnapped as slaves, the beginning of a 400-year system of racial terrorism. It's an amazing series, incredible series. And to me, it's a sign. It's a sign of the karma shifting. Right? Yes, it's easy to see, and I do see so many ways in which it feels like it's not shifting, or it can feel like it's getting worse, with the displays and the actions and the violence that is reacting to change, to go back to the way things were. What the hell does that mean? It's not good on any level. And it's also just literally not possible. But that series is like a Dharma study of karma, of how karma unfolds, of how when we don't attend to things, Nothing goes away. It just becomes more embedded, more entrenched, more systemic. And in the body in which it's become systemic, there is a benefit, right? And so within a dominant group, it benefits that dominant group, just as our delusion seems to benefit us. So when we fulfill our desires, they fulfill us, they give us some pleasure. But the Buddha said, look more and see the danger. See the ways in which they are not benefiting you. Because those ways are much deeper, much more lasting. How do you ask that question? And I love the student's response. I don't know. Please instruct me. What a powerful statement. Please instruct me. I want to know. That's the way seeking mind. In that moment, in a sense, that moment is more important than everything else. Because everything else will follow from that moment. If that moment, without that moment, whatever else follows isn't going to matter so much. That's why cultivating an inquiring mind, a student mind, a beginner's mind is so important. And so to think about in our time now, like, how do we not waste time? What are the questions we should be asking? Are we asking the right questions? When we don't pay attention, Yunmen says, if you don't pay attention, you will miss it. When we don't pay attention, we don't know what we've missed. That's the thing, right? It slipped by, we didn't notice. So we don't know, actually, the cost of that inattention. You know, I think of it all the time. I stepped out after a workshop last night. I was going for a walk, and I saw a young father, you know, pushing his beautiful little baby in a stroller down the street and completely consumed with something on his cell phone, which let's just assume it was important. But in that moment, there's an expression, a living expression of what's important. You know, when I was in New Zealand, I was talking with some students who were nurses and in healthcare, and they were talking about they're trying to get women who have just given birth to wait 30 minutes before they go on their phones and start sending photographs. Because what happens in those 30 minutes is they're not holding their baby. And I thought, 30 minutes? Maybe that's all they thought was reasonable to ask for. So it's in that moment. Yes, there are other things that are important, but like in this moment, what's important? And when we don't pay attention, we don't know what we've missed. And sometimes we can get that back, and sometimes you can't. Sometimes you don't get that back. Right? Because that was the moment that it came to, and you don't get another chance at that. Time swiftly passes by, and opportunities are lost. That's what this practice is about, is recognizing that. The wonder of simplicity, we chant in the Workgatha. Of being in this moment. Those are just words. And I remember thinking, you know, so what's the big deal about the moment? You know, I mean, it's like, okay, I'm here. It's like, my life's still hard. So it's like, oh, wait a minute. Am I here? What does here mean? What is it beyond meaning? What is the direct experience? And so Daitaroshi says, it is rather the self-fulfilling samadhi of joyous activity. This is the life of the Buddha, all those who came before us, it's our life. If we would allow it. We've received it in a sense. The message has been sent. Has it been received? And to think of this within this moment of our lives and of our time, which is demanding all that we have to offer, more than we think we have, is being called upon. And I think in order to really meet this, Dogen said, do we have the courage? And I think part of that courage is to experience our grief. Our grief at our world. And the pain that we are in. The suffering that we are creating. And not just within the human realm, not by a long shot. And that if we allow ourselves to actually encounter that, we will grieve. And that, I think that's really important. Because it also means you're alive. And you care. And at the same time, we have to learn how to hold that grief. Because if we dwell in it, it paralyzes us. Right? Or we just go numb because we can't hold it. You can hold it. I can hold it. Yeah, sometimes it's overwhelming. But we have that capacity. We're built for that. We've been experiencing adversity as long as we've been around. Right? We have that within us. And Buddhadharma gives us a treasure house of skillfulness in how to not only hold it, but move into it. And ultimately find our joyous activity, even within the suffering. And in that way, we learn how to atone for our own actions and free ourselves of our misguided actions. And in facing the actions of others that have impacted us and others, we learn how to use that rather than be used by it. To create more suffering for ourselves, we learn how to use that suffering to strengthen our own resolve, our compassion, our resilience, our stamina. I don't know if there's been a better time for bodhisattva training, really. I mean, probably everybody's always thought that. But I think we have bragging rights, unfortunately. And so in that way, we are called upon. So I'll end with a poem. Please know this. The mind that asks is the mind that already knows before understanding. Before knowing, so clear and bright it blinds you. After knowing, so clear and bright to guide you. Once upon a time, time had not yet arrived. Now, time has come and belongs to you. May we not waste this brief flickering light. May we not waste this boundless, abundant day.
Thanks for listening. You can find more Dharma Talks, interviews, and events at zmm.org/media. While online, please check out the Jizo Project, our multifaceted initiative to make Zen Mountain Monastery more accessible and welcoming to all. Learn about the new Jizo House building and accessibility enhancements to existing facilities that are just two aspects to this exciting endeavor. Find out more and see how you can get involved at zmm.org/JizoProject. That's JizoProject.